Okay, happy 4th of July weekend. I'm sure we all had a good night's sleep on the 4th of July and there were no fireworks or big bangs going off at all. Man. So I've got two announcements and then a story and then the Dharma talk. So the first announcement is the book Urban Dharma is doing well. And positive reviews. Even people that know me seem to like the book. YouTube changed its policy. It was sad for me to hear that they're closing down Google Play podcasts. Because I sort of had bookends. I had Apple podcasts and Google Play podcasts, so Android and Apple and da da da. And apparently they weren't doing very well. So they closed it down and they sent me an email and they said, you can move your podcast to YouTube now. And I said, wow, one media platform for videos and audio. It took 3 days, moved them all over. I changed the name to Urban Dharma, easier to spell than Kusala Bhikshu. So YouTube, Urban Dharma, and we now have 400 combined, audio and video. Available for download, absolutely free. Son of a gun. Life keeps going on. Story. The Buddha and Ananda were traveling, and they saw a river, and they saw a little ferry boat would hold a couple people. And Ananda said, how much does a ferry cost? And the driver said, 5 cents. 5 cents apiece. The Buddha said, pay him, Ananda. So they paid the money and they're going across the river. And all of a sudden on the bank was this yogi, all dressed in white, magnificent. And he stepped off the shore and started walking across the water. Wow. Ananda was blown away. He said, Buddha, you could do that. Why didn't you do that? And the Buddha said, how much did it cost us to take the ferry boat? He said, 5 cents apiece. The Buddha said, that's how much walking on water is worth. 5 cents. So I'm going to revisit meditation because yesterday at Leisure World on Seal Beach, we had a long discussion on meditation. What the heck is meditation? Why do we do it? How do you do it? How many kinds of meditation are there? Can you enlighten this, Kusala? I said, no, I don't speak in a profound way, but I can give you some basic information. They said, that's good enough. Two kinds of Buddhist meditation, samatha meditation, tranquility, and vipassana meditation, insight. 40 different kinds of tranquility meditation, 4 kinds of insight meditation. So which one did the Buddha do? The Buddha did both. He was taught by the yogis of India how to do samatha meditation, tranquility meditation. And it's said in the stories of the Buddha that he became always better than the teacher. It didn't take him long, but he mastered the techniques. And the teacher often would ask him to take over the disciples, the students. And the Buddha said, no. So he had 3 or 4 teachers and they all taught him and he was really good. But the problem he found with tranquility meditation, it didn't last. It was temporary. When you went into all the different states of deep concentration, your suffering ended. You became, in the present moment, a new person. But once the gong rang and the meditation was over, everything came back. All that suffering came back. So he said, this isn't it. And then he rediscovered insight meditation, vipassana. And the reason they call it rediscovered is because 27 Buddhists before him had also practiced insight meditation, which allowed all of them to achieve nirvana. So the Buddha said, okay, this is cool. So he started meditating, doing insight meditation, and sure enough, at the age of 35, he achieved nirvana. The end of suffering, the end of karma, the end of all future rebirths. Very good. So what's the difference? And should we do both of them, or should we only do one of them? What would you say, Kusla? How many would you do? Well, I would recommend doing both of them. And I'll tell you why. Because you need a little tranquility in your life when you achieve a lot of insight into the true nature of this world we live in. And all you have to do is watch the local news, and you'll know how important calm, balance, equanimity, and peace can be. Because you look out in the world, and there's none of that. Nobody is peaceful. Nobody is happy. This is the most amazing experience you will ever have as a being that exists in the world. This life of yours. Unbelievable. Who could have known? Even if they told you about your life, you wouldn't believe them. How could that be, you'd say? I don't understand. So we're going to talk about being happy at the end. There is a place for happiness in Buddhism. It may not be obvious, because all we talk about is suffering. But we also talk about the end of suffering, which is where the happiness comes in. Tranquility meditation, 40 different kinds. I'm going to talk about breath, following your breath. You want to be a sentry. You want to stand outside your nostril, the consciousness that you have. And you want to observe the breath going out and the breath coming in. And you don't want to think about long breath or short breath or good breath or bad breath. You just want to focus in on the sensation of breath. And why is that? Because sensation always happens right now in this present moment. And I'm sure when you were a kid, your parents might have told you, you know how you can tell if what you're experiencing is true? Pinch yourself. If you can feel the pinch, that means it's true and real, because it's happening in the present moment. So the sensation of breath happens in the present moment as well. And this is sustained concentration. And you bring your consciousness to the tip of your nose, and five characteristics arise. Applied thought, sustained thought, happiness, bliss, and equanimity. Now, think of a wild horse that you want to break and be able to ride eventually. And you get the lasso and you go out there and you lasso the horse, and he would buck and he'd try to run away and he'd try to kick you, and you held on, really held on. And if you did it long enough, he would just sort of calm down. And you could actually take the rope off of him and he'd stand right there. He wouldn't even run away. You broke him. Okay, so we want to break our consciousness from going away, because it gets bored really easy. It's not going to be excited about following the sensation of breath. The beginning and the end is exactly the same. There's no story there. So you hold it there, and you hold it there, and you hold it there, and eventually it simply rests on the sensation of breath without willfully applying the intention of holding it there. Applied thought, sustained thought. Those two characteristics fall away. Now you have three characteristics left. Happiness, bliss, and equanimity. So we're going to talk about bliss, which is also known as pleasure. And if you're paying attention to what I'm saying, what you realize is that Buddhism is a path of renunciation. You don't gain anything. You get rid of all the stuff that prevents you from being in nirvana or being in enlightenment. Oftentimes the Zen masters will say, you're already there. And you look around and say, this is it? And he'd say, not yet, not quite yet, but you're already there. You just don't know it. It's like us today. saying, I wish I was in Los Angeles. And somebody would come up and say, didn't you look at the map? You are. And you'd say, no, this doesn't feel like Los Angeles. But it is. And enlightenment and nirvana are. So now we're going to have to deal with bliss or pleasure. Because pleasure gets in the way. And we don't want it to get in the way. So what we do is we now think about how can I let go of pleasure? Because the pleasure disturbs my consciousness. It's like throwing a boulder into a quiet lake, and all ripple effect. So if I can get rid of the pleasure, then I have a much calmer mind. And ironically, if you can get rid of the pleasure, you can get rid of the pain as well. Because it's a dichotomy. You can't have one without the other. And how do you do that? And you say to yourself, I can't do it, because I'm hardwired to experience pleasure, and I'm hardwired to experience pain, and that gives me the signals I need to stay alive in a variety of circumstances. And then the meditator would say, aha, it's not my job to get rid of pleasure. It's my job to get rid of the attachment to pleasure and the aversion to pain. Attachment and aversion. And what did the Buddha say one of the major causes of suffering is? Attachment, clinging, holding on to all the good, pushing away all the bad. And we can't do it. You can't push away the bad. You can't cling to the good. Everything is in a constant state of flux and change. So the meditator reflects on attachment to pleasure and aversion to pain and comes up with a solution. Now, for each and every one of us, we may have a uniquely personal solution. There's just no one thing. It depends on you and your karma and your birth and your life and your death. All those things go in to finding the attachment to pleasure and the aversion to pain. But you succeed. You stick with it. You've done it. I don't feel the pleasure anymore, and I don't feel the pain anymore. I got two characteristics to go, happiness and equanimity. So now I find that happiness is more subtle than pleasure, but still creates these little wavelets in my consciousness. And if I could get rid of my attachment to happiness and my aversion to sadness, the quiet pond would become still and reflective, just like our consciousness becomes. So the meditator works really hard to get rid of the attachment to happiness and the aversion to unhappiness and sadness, and succeeds. And now there's only one characteristic left which we don't want to get rid of. And it is called equanimity, perfect balance of mind, attachment, non-attachment at the same time. Profound, blissful, but not in the old sense, in the new sense. We have substituted bliss and happiness for peace. An amazing accomplishment to have inner peace in every situation you find yourself in. But then the gong rings, and all that stuff goes out the window. And you're on the 405, and somebody cuts you off, and you curse them. And you go, what happened to all my peace and my calm? I worked hours and days and months to achieve it, and it's right out the window, which is the same thing that the Buddha found as he was working on his tranquility. So now we get into insight meditation. And the reason I think it's important to do tranquility meditation first and insight meditation second is because when you get into this insight stuff, it can be really difficult to see and experience and to integrate because it's not what you think it is. A great Zen master once said, you've meditated a long time, And now you think you're going crazy. But you're no crazier than you were yesterday. So you're going to be looking at the world in a much different way now, after you get through this insight meditation. It's four kinds of insight meditation: mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of sensations, mindfulness of the mind, mindfulness of mental objects. So I'm going to talk about sensation and body. Okay, mindfulness of the body. Oftentimes it's just being aware of the posture that you are holding in that present moment. Are you sitting? I'm mindful of sitting. That's it. We don't go good sitting, bad sitting, long sitting, short sitting. I'm sitting. I stand up. I'm standing. That's it. We're noting. I'm walking. That's it. I'm lying down. That's it. Mindfulness of body posture. And every time you do that, what's happening? You're coming back to the present moment experience of your life. You're not sleepwalking through the world. You're right there, right here, right now. Okay. Mindfulness of sensations. Three kinds of sensations, the Buddha said. He kept it simple. We have good sensations, we have bad sensations, and we have neutral sensations. And most of the time, neutral sensations don't get our attention. They're not worth noting. In fact, even they're almost invisible. But the good ones and the bad ones, man, we're right there. Okay, so the meditator is sitting on the floor, cross-legged, scanning his body, top of the head to the tip of the toes, up and down, looking for sensations. Thousands of them, hundreds of them, tens of them, many sensations. It depends how much time you want to spend. So you're scanning, and all of a sudden, it stops at the knee. Oh, my knee hurts. I shouldn't have done that marathon yesterday. Man. Okay, sensation, good, bad, or neutral? Bad sensation. Noted. Continue scanning. Okay. Man, that elbow, I hit it at the wall yesterday. Man, that really hurts. Okay. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, unpleasant. Wow. So what you're going to find, if you're new to meditation, if you're a beginner, and we're always a beginner, but if you think yourself as a beginner, most of the sensations are going to be uncomfortable, not happy sensations, not good sensations. This is the physical pain, and it doesn't have to be great pain, it could just be little teeny pains that we struggle with every day. And as we get older, more and more seem to arise. What happened to my body? Why does it hurt all the time now? I'm only 81. What the hell? Wait till you're 82, man. You'll find even more. Okay. So you're going, and then the meditator hangs in there and all of a sudden starts to have pleasant sensations. Oh, I have a tingling on the back of my spine. Wow, chakra. Man, releasing this spiritual energy. Man. Okay, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, pleasant. I want to go back there again. I like that one. So the meditator tries to replicate the situation, the conditions necessary to go back to that really pleasant sensation. Never happens. Can't do it, man. I don't care how long you try to duplicate all those factors, they're always different. Always different. What does that tell you? It tells you that it's always the first time. There's no second time. It's always the first time. Everything you do, everything you say, everything you think, it's never the first time. Wow, what a bummer. Okay. So you continue to scan and continue to scan, and now you have a couple pleasant and a couple unpleasant, and now the job of the meditator is to go in a deep state of reflection, rumination, and seek out the three aspects of Buddhist wisdom. Number one, first aspect, life is ultimately unsatisfactory. What a bummer. Who could have devised that? Where did they find that? Personal experience, man. The Buddha, it was an empirical perspective. He didn't study philosophy. He studied his life. He studied his experience firsthand. He came to the conclusion that life is ultimately unsatisfactory. When he went through the city with his charioteer Chana, what did he see? First thing he saw was this really sick guy. And then he saw this really old guy. And then he saw this really dead guy. If that doesn't turn your head, I don't know what does. But then he continued through the streets of the city and he saw this really holy guy, all dressed in white, calm, collected, peaceful, radiant. Man. Siddhartha Gautama, soon to be the Buddha, said, "That's what I want to be. I want to be one of those guys." Okay. And he made it too. So, the first aspect of Buddhist wisdom is that life is ultimately unsatisfactory, but not always unsatisfactory. There are plenty of good times. There are plenty of sensations. There are plenty of parties to go to and cars to drive and movies to see. All that stuff's there too. But the problem with that is the second aspect of Buddhist wisdom, which is impermanence. That everything changes. All this good stuff we experience today, it always changes. Even Disneyland has to close. They won't let you live there. The happiest place on earth, man. Okay, so now we're seeing, okay, yeah, I got it now. Ultimate reality is that life is ultimately unsatisfactory for human beings as well as all creatures. But we can do something about it. Impermanence, constant state of flux and change. Everything is always that way. No, it never stays the same very long, sometimes just moment to moment. There was a politician that said, was asked the question, "Are you the same person you were 4 years ago?" And the politician said, "Yes, I am." And from the Buddhist perspective, well, we might disagree. Now we come to the third aspect of Buddhist wisdom, the most difficult to understand. The third aspect of Buddhist wisdom is you are not who you think you are. Now I know when you got up today, you probably washed up and looked in the mirror and combed your hair. I know I did. And then that reflection was you. And you recognized yourself because you'd seen it many times before. And you'll see it many more times in the future. But what is that? Okay, that is an illusion that was placed there. Starting with your parents who said, "Don't do this, and don't do that, and don't do this, and don't do that." And your little body said, "Who are they talking to? I don't exist in that way. Don't do this, and don't do that. Oh, no." And then your mom says, "I'm mom." So you're looking out, and now you recognize mom became a person, a separate entity for the first time. Until then, mom and you were just connected. Connected. And now mom's over here, and you're over there. And sooner or later, dad comes into the picture, and he's over there. And we're all separate and all unique. And all scared to hell. And you go, "Wow, okay, yeah, I get it now. And that's a chair over there, and I'm not the chair. And that's a door, and I'm not the door. And these are my shoes, and I'm not a shoe. I am unique and separate. And that's why I have this underlying feeling of dissatisfaction, because I've been kicked out of the universe. The universe doesn't allow me in again in the same way it did when I was just a little small baby. And the universe and me were exactly the same thing, but no longer." And then we go to school for 18 years, and they teach us how to be us, and we get a career, and that forces us to be a certain way, you know? And then we might get married. And then that person who you lived with your whole life, you have now become a father, a husband, a person no longer separate. And there's mom and wife and a person no longer separate. But we form this, we've been unified in the wonderful marriage that we all strive for. And then you go, wow, I was this, and now I'm this, and now I have to do this, and I got to be this, and I got to be so many different people all the time. Who am I really now? And you're just a process going on, man. You're just a process going on. And once in a while you're this, and once in a while you're that, but that's all you, but it's never just one thing. It's all the things you've ever been collected in this sort of ever-changing reality that you call you. Wow. No wonder we want to sleep a lot. It's just so difficult to be all those people all the time. But we are not the self. There is no self. It's an illusion. It was created so we could exist because we needed to be separate from the environment. The environment will kill you if you're not separate from it. You know? You ever heard of a widowmaker? Yeah. What a trip that is. People love the forest. I'm a little scared of the forest. I'd much rather walk on cement and asphalt. But you're walking through the forest and all of a sudden a big limb falls off the tree and kills you. A widowmaker. And if the limb doesn't kill you, the bear over there will. And then you got the rattlesnake over there, and you got this poisonous spider over here, and everybody's just so eager to go out back to nature. Back to nature. Man. So here we are deciding now about our new reality. Everything is ultimately unsatisfactory. Everything changes all the time. And I am not who I think I am. And those three things in combination allow you to be free. Now, I know it sounds really weird. This is the end result of the Buddhist path, is to be free. Absolutely. Not in a physical sense, but in a psychological sense. And you'd have to say, free? Does that mean I get to do anything I want? Not that kind of free. That's the 12-year-old mentality free. Our kind of free is free from suffering. Never have to suffer again. And the Buddha said the main problem with life is birth. If you weren't born, you wouldn't suffer, man. So I don't teach how not to die. I teach how not to be reborn. And once you achieve nirvana, it ends your suffering, it ends your karma, and it ends all future rebirths, because what migrates from lifetime to lifetime in Buddhism is not a soul, but it's your karmic energy. So as long as you have karma, you'll be reborn. So I looked at my family, I go, well, mom, dad, and I had karma. I showed up a couple years ago. You know, and I couldn't have done it without mom, I couldn't have done it without dad, and I couldn't have done it without my karma. So Buddhist meditation is designed not to transform your body, it's designed to transform your consciousness, to get rid of the greed and the hatred and delusion, and exchange it for generosity, kindness, and wisdom. How long does it take? Rarely is it one lifetime. It takes a while. But in each lifetime that follows, it'll be better. You might not remember your past efforts, but they'll be obvious in your karma. And you'll have a little better life each time. And then finally, when you make it, when you achieve nirvana, like the Buddha did, then the real work starts. You help everybody. The Buddha didn't sleep. He got a couple hours, but people wanted to talk to him. His spiritual eye, his third eye, could see who was suffering and who needed help, and he would go find them. And somebody asked yesterday, well, did the Buddha stop meditating after he achieved nirvana? No. The Buddha meditated until his last breath. And you'd say, well, but why would he do that? He already got the final goal. He already achieved nirvana. He never had to suffer again. Yeah, but he had an old body. He died at 80. And he walked a lot. They didn't have cars back then. And sometimes he literally had to sit down because he was tired and his back hurt. The Buddha was tired and his back hurt? Yeah, man, he was a human being, just like us. What he did change was his consciousness. He didn't change his body. And when he went into tranquility meditation, remember the characteristics of tranquility meditation? He'd go into the fourth jhana, which is the deepest form. That's where you find the equanimity and perfect balance of mind. So no matter how bad he felt, he could come to that place of acceptance and not suffer. He couldn't get rid of the pain, but he never suffered again because of the pain, which is hard for us to understand. So when he was dying, what did he do? He went into the fourth jhana and died in the fourth jhana. Peace, calm, equanimity, and balance. We should all be so lucky. I'm going to stop there. We just talked about life, death, and everything in between. We got it. Anybody have any questions about what I talked about? Anybody remember what I said? Okay. All the smiling faces. They're all happy.
I'm still attached to Durga.
You're still attached to?
You mentioned
Yeah.
So how do we handle dukkha better?
How do we handle what?
Dukkha.
Dukkha. Thanks. Steve, you're talking soft and I can't hear very well. That's a bad combination. Well, dukkha, the idea is to get rid of the conditions that cause dukkha. Okay, and that's what meditation does. And when you talk about suffering or dukkha, it has no color and it has no form and it has no size and it has no taste. And it has no smell. And yet you ask somebody, can you see suffering? And they say, yeah, everywhere. Look at all these people. What you're seeing is a person's response to suffering. You see what I'm saying? That you can't separate the suffering from the person because the person is reacting to the suffering. You see the reaction. You don't see the suffering. You don't see dukkha. And the way the person gets rid of the dukkha is to come to a place of perfect balance, perfect acceptance of the way things are. And then you don't suffer. So, having said that, everybody's going to go, well, how can you accept the way things are? It's terrible out there. And the deal is, yeah, it is terrible out there. And you're a Buddhist. And you see somebody who's suffering because they're hungry, you get them something to eat. Okay. But you do it with peace and calm and clarity. You know? You're not trying to save the world. You're just trying to reduce a little suffering. And you found somebody. And if you want to practice, all you got to do is go outside. Walk down the street. Thousands of people out there suffering. You don't want to suffer along with them. You don't want to suffer because of them. You want to have that inner peace and tranquility. So I'll tell you a good way to start, Steve, is when next time you use a vending machine, leave the change behind, man. Don't take it out of the change slot. And somebody will find it, and you'll make their day for a quarter, man. Ending suffering, one vending machine at a time. Was that helpful, Steve? Okay. Good. Okay, well, if there are no other questions, thank you all for showing up on this wonderfully hot and 4th of July weekend. And I will turn it over to the universe, man. The universe.